and endorsed U.S. power. This was not blunt force trauma, which the Afghans had witnessed most recently in the Soviet occupation, followed by their horrible civil war. They now saw surgical, exact strikes with speed and stealth. Because of these precision bombing and commando raids, in part, many Afghans began to perceive the United States as a reliable and effective ally. We were destroying foreigners in their midst, along with their cruel Taliban allies, while avoiding Afghan civilian casualties. The Afghans, of course, did not know about our UAV Predators, Joint Direct Attack Munitions, JDAMs, or laser-guided munitions. They just understood that, whenever the United States wanted, a truckload of AQ fighters would suddenly explode. We strived for improvements at every turn. After analysis of several Hellfire strikes of enemy combatants in pickup trucks, we realized that some were surviving the hit. We could see them, wounded and stumbling away. This was unacceptable. We needed more fragmentation at the point of impact. We asked for help from our contractors, specifically Chuck Boom Boom Vessels. He immediately understood our problem. He quickly came back with a sketch. The design was elegant and simple. He would fabricate a metal sleeve perforated with holes the size of a quarter that slipped over the warhead. The modification would be fast and easy. Boom Boom explained that this should increase the fragmentation by at least 25% and expand the radius of the kill zone, perhaps also by 25%. Within 2 weeks, we had the fragmentation sleeves wrapped around the warheads. We analyzed several strikes. Boom Boom's estimates turned out to be conservative. Nobody walked away. Our revolutionary weapon system was low cost, low risk, and low profile, yet delivered high impact, especially when intelligence found and fixed high-value targets. War would never be the same. Downrange. With the air campaign on track and coordinated ground operations slowly gaining momentum, I needed to visit Afghanistan and confer with our Afghan allies. Schroen had been in the Panjshir for 6 weeks, laying the foundation for the assault on Kabul and the outlying areas, including United Front forces in the far north, poised to sweep down upon Kunduz from the mountains in the east. His team, codenamed Jawbreaker, paved the way for the 1st U.S. Army Special Forces A-Team, No. 555. Also known as the Triple Nickel, they had deployed from 5th Group, based in Karshi Khanabad Air Base, Uzbekistan. They were now co-located with Jawbreaker in the same collection of houses deep in the Panjshir. Both Jawbreaker and Triple Nickel were expanding their coverage, with recon teams on the northern fringes of the Somali plains. Jawbreaker needed CIA reinforcements and a change in leadership. Schroen, the preeminent South Asia veteran ops officer, was the perfect choice to be the first into Afghanistan after 9/11. He had helped us understand how the campaign would unfold, particularly in the northeast of Afghanistan. He had given confidence to the CIA's leadership, including me, with his plain-spoken predictions of a Taliban collapse once we delivered concentrated and coordinated air power with United Front ground forces. Schroen had encouraged our Afghan allies. He had also managed their expectations. For example, Fahim and other United Front leaders demanded that all CIA and SF teams entering Afghanistan first come to the Panjshir, as if the United Front acted as some sovereign entity for the entire nation-state, approving each entry. They wanted their outpost in the Panjshir to serve as a customs and border entry point for all our deployments. This was a blatant and ridiculous attempt to establish their de facto authority. Schroen relayed this to me during a secure call. I told him there was no way. This concept made no sense operationally, logistically, or politically. Schroen understood, but knew our allies might not be happy. This, however, was a moot point. What were they going to do? Tell us not to come? Try to stop us? They had been fighting the Taliban for years, and now, with us, they had the perfect opportunity for victory. I knew that our allies, like any, would seek to gain advantage where they could, but this request was incredibly stupid. I shared my perspective with Schroen. He, in turn, explained this to our allies, in more respectful terms, I assume. Now we needed Burnson with his mad dog warrior ethos. He would assume command of Jawbreaker. I wanted him to lead us into Kabul and beyond. Once in place among our Afghan allies, and as long as he could draw a breath, Burnson would never stop. Team Alpha was south of Mazar. They needed a few more CIA officers, plus an SF team that had been thwarted by bad weather for the last few weeks. It was driving Rumsfeld crazy. CIA officers were in the field, and his men were not. I heard this from friends in the Pentagon and in Tampa. Rumsfeld even called Colonel John Mulholland in Uzbekistan, the SF 5th Group commander and a great partner, to chew him out, as if the weather was Mulholland's fault. After more than a month in CIA HQS, I needed a quick recon downrange. I needed to meet our Afghan allies there. I needed to see our men. I needed to see the land I had been thinking about for the last 3 years to see how we would destroy AQ in Afghanistan. General Franks was planning a trip to meet with the United Front leadership, specifically General Mohammad Fahim, in Dushanbe, Tajikistan. He and I discussed how best to achieve our objectives with our Afghan allies. I told him that I needed to get into Afghanistan, so we agreed that I would join him for the meeting with Fahim before my onward deployment. I told him that we would bring the intelligence, the relationships, the money, and the translator for the meeting. CENTCOM would bring everything else, including my ride into Afghanistan. I invited General Franks to send one of his senior staff to join me in Afghanistan. I suggested General Gary Harrell, whom I had worked with in Yemen the previous year. Frank selected Admiral Burt Calland. Burt was one of the most senior-ranking Navy SEALs. I had met him only once before, when I had visited Tampa. Burt was a good choice. We needed to deploy Burnson and the reinforcements for Jawbreaker and Team Alpha as soon as possible. The quickest way was via the Gulfstream aircraft that I was taking to Dushanbe. Our logistics guys figured that we could all jam ourselves, along with our weapons and gear, into the plane. It would be tight. Cindy drove me to the airport, where the private jets parked. We walked to the aircraft. There were no tears and no expressed angst, just a hug and a kiss. I told her that I would be back in a couple of weeks. We had informed the boys, all now back in school after the quick shift from our post overseas, that I was going to Afghanistan. At this point, there was little need to hide such an obvious fact. After all, they were smart and saw me packing for a high mountain expedition, not some official public jaunt. While I was gone, Cindy would have to answer their questions and deal with their problems. On top of that, she was sticking with our weak cover story about our reassignment, citing safety concerns and new government priorities to the neighbors and some of our own family. I watched her walk away, back toward the hangar, and thought about her strength and how much I admired her, how much I loved her. I turned back to our CIA team gathered on the tarmac, next to our sleek white jet. Everything was packed. A couple of the guys looked agitated, however. One had his jaw clenched tightly. Another looked downright depressed. This was unusual. CIA paramilitary guys prided themselves on maintaining a cool, phlegmatic demeanor. "What's the problem?" I asked. "Our medic. He's detailed to the CIA from DOD, and we're waiting on his clearance to join us."
"What clearance?"
"He's with the CIA. Let's go."
"No, sir, it's not that easy. The secretary must approve this."
"The secretary? The Secretary of Defense?" I asked, dumbfounded.
"Yes, sir, at least his office."
"Well, call them."
We have, sir. We have been working on this for a couple of weeks.
A cell phone rang, and there was a brief discussion, not pleasant.
Sir, it's a no-go.
You have to be shitting me.
No, sir, the secretary's office has refused his clearance to join us.
Why?
I asked.
I don't know, sir. They were all embarrassed, especially the medic. I was flabbergasted and enraged, but could do nothing. We had to board and leave now.
We left the medic.
As the plane began to taxi, I sat in my seat, strapped into the 4-point belt buckle, wondering how in God's name could we win this war with a DOD so dysfunctional. Or worse, maybe these dickheads were more concerned about their administrative prerogative than saving the lives of our men on the battlefield. Whatever the reason and the motivation, the result was the same. We would be short a medic.